It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Predator drone has become a mainstay of American military efforts, but the technology got off to a rocky start. A guest shares the secret origins of the drone revolution.
First, the University of Wisconsin System announced yesterday that it's creating a task force on sexual violence and harassment. The news comes on the heels of President Obama's White House task force to protect students from sexual assault, which was launched last month.
It also follows news earlier this week that members of a UW-Milwaukee fraternity were alleged to have spiked drinks with a date rape drug. UW System President Ray Cross says the 21-member task force's aim is to ensure UW campuses are, quote, safe and welcoming places to live, work, and learn.
With us now is Vicki Washington, Associate Vice President for Inclusivity, Diversity, Equity, and Student Success at the UW System. She's co-chair of the new Sexual Violence Task Force. Vicki, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the announcement today came that the UW System is creating a task force on sexual violence. What is the focus of the task force?
Sure. The task force has been created to, I would say, kind of to take a really high-level assessment of the degree that our campuses are welcome and safe and inclusive for all of our students and employees. It was created largely because it was time for us to review our practices and policies. And as you are aware, there has been a lot of recently a lot of national attention on the issue of sexual violence and sexual assault as it relates to students.
Would you say that the task force, the existence of the task force, is in a way an admission that the existing policies aren't doing enough?
No, not at all. As you know, anytime you have a set of policies and procedures, it's only good practice to periodically review their effectiveness. Are they doing what they're designed to do? The consistency of practice in terms of implementation. And then if there have been any changes in the laws or parameters that prescribe the policies, then you want to check for that as well. Our universities here in the UW system have, for quite some time now, had some pretty robust policies, some exceptional educational and prevention programs aimed at students, students can take training programs. In fact, at Madison, I think they have a program that first-year students are required to take. We have been conducting training for employees, and we have people with various levels of responsibility for assuring that we have campuses that are free of harassment and sexual violence. We provide good supports for victims of violence. So, no, this isn't our kind of first foray into this territory. We are strengthening the policies and practices that we have.
I know it's early on in the task force. The announcement just came today. But are there any sorts of benchmarks that you would like to look at?
So we have not, the task force has not set the benchmarks per se. We met for the first time yesterday. We have organized ourselves into work groups that are going to be focused on particular areas of concern that we need to examine. And then those work groups will set the milestones and benchmarks for themselves. We do know that we have to evaluate our current array of policies and practices against several things that have come out of the federal government in the last few years. One is something called a Dear Colleague Letter. It's not really regulations, but it is, I would say, a strong advisory letter is how I would characterize it. And then the other, there were a couple of reports that came out of the White House, the most recent being Not Alone, and then a PR campaign called It's on All of Us. And so we will be using those to guide our thinking and our work here in the UW system.
Can you give us a sense of who's on this 21-member task force?
We have approximately 19 people on the task force from around the campuses, and there's someone on there, I'm sure, from every UW system institution. The types of functions and positions they hold include people who are deans of students, people who are in the health and counseling area, affirmative action directors, people who work in human resources. We have a couple of students on there. We have people who work in the area of residence life. We have a faculty member and a dean on there. And then there are those of us who work for UW System who are ex officio members of the task force.
And how do you expect these task members to proceed as they get going?
Well, we will convene a number of meetings of the body of the whole task force, and a lot of the production work that needs to be done will occur within the work groups. We will also include, I would say, people who are not official members of the task force, but also have expertise. And many of these people work at our universities, and the task force had to necessarily be of limited size. But in carrying out the work, we really want to engage additional practitioners that are topical content experts to help us so that at the end of the day, we have the buy-in, the policies and practices are both robust but and yet feasible and practical in terms of implementation.
Vicki, how serious a problem would you say sexual violence is on UW campuses?
I don't know that it's any more serious than it is on some other campuses. I'll just say that any sexual violence is a problem. What we want to do, if we can do that at all, is ensure that it doesn't happen. And if we're not successful in that, we want to make sure we've taken all preventive steps to minimize the likelihood that it will happen.
And one area that some attention has been focused on when it comes to sexual assaults is fraternities. Will the task force be looking at the role that fraternities may have in sexual assault?
Yes, the task force will look at everything. So we spent a good bit of time talking about this during the meeting yesterday. We'll look at fraternities. We'll look at the questions of alcohol and drinking. We will look at other safety issues as it pertains to campus life. So, you know, I don't think any particular area is going to be exempt or singled out.
Now, you are working, it sounds like, in cooperation and partnership with the federal government and some of the initiatives that are coming out of the White House. Is there particular guidance there that is kicking it off for you?
I would say it's a sum total of things that they've issued in the last few years. We have to really reconcile kind of, and the thing is that a lot of the directions or directives that have come out of the federal government are really designed to assure that universities across the country are taking Title IX very seriously and implementing all aspects of it to the degree necessary to assure safe learning environments. And so what we're doing is following that guidance and reconciling any policy or practice differences that we think might exist if we come upon those, or strengthening practices where we could do better than we're doing.
Now, President Obama in the White House launched their It's On Us campaign. You referenced that earlier, which is aimed to get bystanders involved in preventing sexual violence. How do you expect initiatives like that and the task force, what you'll be doing, to translate into behavior change on campuses?
Good question. So, you know, I think in terms of things like It's On Us and anti-bullying types of campaigns, I think there are it's a multifaceted campaign. So one would be kind of broadcast and social media as a way to get messaging out. The other would be training people who are willing to take a leadership role and work with their peers. And then the other may be some other forms of incentives that the universities can make available to student organizations to engage them in the campaign as well. So we know, generally speaking, that, you know, the students are going to their peers are going to have more influence over them than, say, an administrator, generally speaking. So we'll find ways to get them engaged.
Now, you said earlier that you thought, in terms of the problem of sexual violence on UW system campuses, that the UW wasn't doing much differently than its peers. Some statistics put the number of sexual assaults on college campuses at 1 in 5 students being raped. And I think parents and students would say, that's probably not an acceptable number. What would you say to those people about what you're going to do?
Yeah, so I would say if those statistics are accurate, 1 in 5 is unacceptable. I don't think there's any real debate about that. There is a debate about how that they arrived at that number. I think at our campuses, it's a wide range of numbers. You know, the real question is, you know, whether or not people are getting, we can prevent it, and then if it happens, what are we doing to assist those individuals, and what are the remedial steps that we will take to help the person and also assure that it doesn't reoccur. So I think if you were to look at the data for this type of offense, I don't think you would find that our campuses are among the top in the country. I would, you know, so I would say we don't have any more than average, but then it would, you would have to look at institutions of a particular size and a particular location to really get a good comparison. But the bottom line is we don't, whatever is happening, we want it to stop. You know, any incidents of violence are unacceptable, and that is going to be our operating mantra.
Vicki, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Vicki Washington, Associate Vice President for Inclusivity, Diversity, Equity, and Student Success. She's co-chair of the new UW System Task Force on Sexual Violence.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, News Guy Noah Ovshinsky joins us for a look at the top state news stories of the week, including today's decision from an appeals court on whether or not it would take up voter ID again.
First, once upon a time, flying drones were seen as not much more than toys and met with serious skepticism from military planners.
But in the last decade, drones led by the Predator drones have become a huge part of the American military efforts and of the nation's counterterrorism program.
Our next guest tells the story of the drones rise to prominence. Richard Whittle is a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center. He's covered the military for three decades, and he's the author of the new book, Predator, The Secret Origins of the Drone Revolution. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into the history, we've been hearing in the news today drones being used against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. How big a part of our military and counterterrorism efforts are drones today?
Well, I don't have the exact numbers of how many they're using over there, of course, but you can bet that they're playing an important role because, you know, the important thing that these drones do these days, and the Predator was the first, is that they can stay in the air for anywhere from 24 to 40 hours. And that provides an eye in the sky that allows the military to seek out targets. And that's going to be more and more important now after these initial airstrikes by manned aircraft have forced the ISIS fighters to seek cover among the civilian population. You know, they'll be the U.S. military now has 139 Predators, armed Predators, and 165 armed Reapers, which is a larger derivative of the Predator that carries a heavier weapons load. My book tells the story of how this all started, you know, and I tell the story of how when the day after 9/11, the U.S. Air Force had three armed Predators. They had barely gotten ready. They had been preparing to try to send them to assassinate Osama bin Laden. And they got over to Uzbekistan, where they were going to fly from, and one crashed before the war began. So we've gone from two in the initial weeks on the day that the war in Afghanistan began, October 7, 2001, to quite a large fleet now, and they play a key role in directing other aircraft to targets. They can shine laser designators on targets to guide bombs to them, and they can fire missiles, and the Reaper can drop bombs itself.
Well, let's go back even a little further in the history of the drone. What were the first ancestors of today's drones like?
Well, you know, Rob, the military has been trying to use unmanned aircraft since World War One. They built little biplanes about the size of a go-kart and were planned to put explosives in the nose, and they were called aerial torpedoes. Between the wars, the actor Reginald Denny out in Hollywood developed target drones to train anti-aircraft gunners. And during the Vietnam War, the military had jet-powered drones. They were called Firebees and Fireflies and Lightning Bugs. And they carried still photo cameras for the most part. Some were armed, but they didn't work very well. They only flew about four missions on average before they crashed or were shot down. The Predator came along, and I tell the story of the Predator in this book from its invention in a former Israeli aeronautical engineer's Los Angeles garage, to its arming by the Air Force, to its use on behalf of the CIA, and the military in Afghanistan. And the Predator changed everything, partly because of the genius of this Israeli inventor, Abraham Karam.
Tell us his story. He was born in Baghdad and grew up in Israel.
Right. He was born in Baghdad in 1937. His family moved to Israel, and he was raised there in that sort of socialist culture that prevailed in Israel in the late 1940s and early 1950s in its early days. And he was very precocious. He became a top aeronautical engineer early in life. In his 20s, he was in the Israeli Air Force. By the time he was in his early 30s, he was the director of preliminary design, essentially the director of innovation for Israel Aircraft Industries, the country's most important aerospace company. And then he was seized with the idea during the Yom Kippur War. He was asked to design a drone as a decoy to fool Egyptian and Syrian air defenses. And he was seized with the idea of designing more unmanned aircraft. He left his job after doing that project. He emigrated to the United States and, you know, like all great American inventors, went to work in his garage. And he came up with a configuration for a drone that he called the Albatross, because, you know, the Albatross is a bird that soars better than almost any in nature. And among the things Abe Karam did in Israel as a kid was to make these models called free flight models that are designed to be thrown or towed into the air like a kite and then soar. So he knew how to make a plane stay in the air a long time, and that's what he set out to do, and that changed the whole nature of drones once Abe Karam came up with the configuration, which we still see today in the shape and form of the Predator and the Reaper.
When these first modern drones, what ended up being the ones that are used today, were pitched to the U.S. military, was there reluctance? Was there skepticism?
Absolutely. You know, there was no natural home for drones in the military. In the old days, the Air Force, you know, is run by pilots, and they weren't much interested in aircraft that didn't have one of them in it. And, you know, the Army mainly flies helicopters, so they weren't all that interested in the kind of drone that Abe Karam was coming up with. And Navy captains, you know, never liked having aircraft that have gas in them but no pilot coming in to land on their ships. You know, it's a pretty dangerous operation. And so there was resistance. And, in fact, Abe Karam, you know, went bankrupt trying to sell his Endurance Unmanned Aerial Vehicle, as it's technically called, to the military. Now, two brothers from Denver, Neil and Lyndon Blue, came along. They were incredibly wealthy. They had bought a company from Chevron and renamed it General Atomics. And they were interested in getting into the drone business, and they bought Abe Karam's intellectual property and hired him and his team in 1991. They bought his intellectual property for $1.85 million, and their company has been making many multiples of that ever since, almost ever since, by selling Predators and Reapers and other derivatives to the military.
And just a few years later, they got tested on battlefields as reconnaissance drones, right, in the war in the Balkans.
Exactly, Rob. At first, the Predator was just an eye in the sky. And this is, you know, one of the things that I get into in the book and that I found fascinating about the Predator myself is it was kind of like the first personal computers, you know, the old boxy IBM thing that sat on your desk and wasn't connected to anybody else's, right? So it was a technology that was interesting to a lot of people. But at first, most people didn't really know what they could do with it that was all that special. Innovators came along. They came up with new software, new hardware, new communications architectures that turned the personal computer from a novelty into a necessity. And that's exactly what happened with the Predator. The military bought it and started buying it in 1994 as a test, actually, and it was inspired by the need to find Serb artillery that was bombarding Sarajevo in that terrible war in Bosnia back then. They used it as an eye in the sky, but there was an incredible character, a techno-scientist, whose real name I wasn't permitted to use in the book, but who I call Werner, who came up with innovations that allowed the Predator's video to be streamed directly into the Pentagon and to military command centers elsewhere. He came up with a way for the Predator to be controlled from Germany as it flew over Afghanistan looking for Osama bin Laden in the year 2000. And then he came up with a way for the Predator to be controlled from the United States, specifically from the parking lot of the CIA headquarters building.
And we'll pick up the story from there after the news as we talk to Richard Whittle talking about the rise of drones, Predator drones. His new book is Predator, The Secret Origins of the Drone Revolution.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the rise of drone technology and how drones are used today? Do you think they should be used for counterterrorism strikes or in wars? And do you think the U.S. is overusing drones? Call 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation with Richard Whittle. He's the author of Predator, The Secret Origins of the Drone Revolution.
He tells the story of the invention of modern drones and how they came to be so widely used in the military and counterterrorism here in the United States. You can join in with your questions and your thoughts at 800-642-1234. And do you have thoughts on how much we use drones? Do you think we overuse them, or are they a good substitute for sending in piloted vehicles, sending in troops in some cases? 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. Richard, before the news, you were telling us some of the big innovations, including being able to control drones from anywhere on the planet. Another huge one that made a big difference in the missions they're used for, attaching missiles, specifically Hellfire missiles, to them. How did that come about?
Right, Robin. I was fascinated to learn, you know, before I started the book, I had heard that, well, the CIA armed the Predator. I found actually the Air Force started arming the Predator in May of 2000. And by coincidence, almost, Richard Clark at the National Security Council, who was the chief counterterrorism advisor to President Clinton, and a man named Charlie Allen in the CIA, had come to the conclusion that the United States needed to kill Osama bin Laden before al-Qaeda killed more Americans, as they had done in bombing our embassies in 1998 in Kenya and Tanzania, and as they did again in October 2000, when they bombed the destroyer USS Cole. So an Air Force general suggested to them, they didn't know where Osama bin Laden was precisely, how to target him, and the Air Force suggested, well, send a Predator to look for him. So this first innovation we were talking about, they decided they had to put the ground control station at Ramstein Air Base in Germany, because it takes, you know, the ground control station is roughly the size of a freight container. There are a couple of satellite Earth terminals that are needed. And usually they would fly within 500 miles of where the Predator was going to be, but you couldn't do that from the countries surrounding Afghanistan. So that was an innovation. And I interviewed the pilot who was at the controls, Captain Scott Swanson, when they found Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan. At the time, the Predator was not armed, but the Air Force had a project going to do that. That finding Osama bin Laden with the Predator made that Richard Clark get excited about that project to arm the Predator. And over the next year, in the spring and summer of 2001, an Air Force unit, a very special organization called Big Safari, armed the Predator. And I go into some detail in the book about how they went about that, preparing it for what they thought was going to be a mission to kill Osama bin Laden. Well, they decided they couldn't leave the ground control station in Germany if they were going to pull the trigger on a missile strike from there. So Big Safari, this techno-scientist I mentioned earlier, came up with a way to control the drone from a ground control station parked on the CIA campus in Langley, Virginia, and painted to look like a freight container with a mobile home next to it where the Air Force command center was. And that's how we got to the stage today where we have communications architecture that allows the Air Force to fly Predators and Reapers on around the globe, basically from bases in the United States.
We'll go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Rick on the line in Grafton. Rick, hi, you're on the air.
How you doing? Great subject. Being former military, I personally think that drones save a lot of lives. They gather much more intelligence than you could ever get any other way. And with the advances in facial recognition and other that the computers are doing, it's going to be able to do a lot more surgical kill and save a lot of innocent lives. But, you know, that's my opinion.
Rick, thanks a lot for the call. Richard, is that something you heard from a lot of people
in
the military?
Yeah, I think Rick makes a good point. You know, there is a lot of concern about so-called collateral damage, innocent people being killed in drone strikes. The weapons are actually much more discriminating than what is used in other forms of airstrikes. You know, the average fighter plane is dropping a 500-pound bomb. That's a huge explosion. The Hellfire missile that the Predator carries has a 20-pound warhead, and it's laser-guided. It should hit, I mean, nothing's perfect, but it should hit within a couple of feet of where that laser is pointed. And as Rick suggested, the value of the Predator of these drones is actually more in what the military calls intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, because they can stay overhead far longer than a manned aircraft can, pointing their cameras at the ground, largely unseen, and their video streams directly back to command centers. And thanks to this organization I've mentioned before, Big Safari, soldiers on the ground can carry a Predator screen on a device called a Rover. So it's really been a huge change in the way the military wages war. And I tell the, if I can just mention one more thing, I tell the story in the book of how the Predator saved lives in a famous battle in Afghanistan called Robert's Ridge, partly by being able to tell Army Rangers who were on top of the mountain where the enemy was.
Now, one of the most controversial uses of drones is in the realm of targeted killings. How much back and forth was there over targeting members of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, first of all, and since the period you write about, of course, use in other countries around the world as well?
Right. You know, it was very interesting to me in doing the book to learn in interviewing senior CIA people from those days that there was a lot of angst among at Langley about the whole idea of the CIA controlling a military weapon and using it in a way that could lead to a headline like CIA uses armed drone to assassinate Islamic militant. You know, before 9/11, there was a whole different atmosphere. As you know, the CIA was involved in huge scandals in the 1970s because of assassination plots, and there was actually an executive order banning assassination by the CIA or other U.S. government people. So prior to 9/11, in fact, the Bush administration only took up the whole issue of whether to send the armed Predator after Osama bin Laden on September 4th, 2001. And at that meeting, the CIA director, George Tenet, was unwilling to say that he would take responsibility for pulling the trigger. And the military didn't want to go after Osama bin Laden with an armed drone that only had a 20-pound warhead on it. They wanted to send B-52 bombers if they were going to do anything. So there was a whole different attitude. After 9/11, the gloves came off. And, of course, now a lot of people think that the CIA is basically addicted to using drone strikes to go after terrorists.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Mark on the line in Mineral Point. Mark, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, good afternoon. I want to try to introduce a different perspective on this. I think what we're hearing so far is a lot of cheerleading for technology that is it's really responsible for all kinds of atrocities against innocent people. And all the talk about Osama bin Laden is a big red herring, because mainly what has been done with these drones is to directly or indirectly kill tons of innocent civilians. With the propaganda that all these people being killed are all terrorists. And the word terrorist is also a red herring. That's my opinion.
Mark, thanks for the call. There have been cases of innocent civilians being hit. Weddings, I think, in Pakistan in drone attacks, I think, Richard.
Absolutely. No, there certainly have been mistakes. In fact, I quote a general in my book as saying, look, in the early days, you know, any tall man was somebody that we might want to go after, and mistakes were made. You know, the point that I would make, I'm not cheerleading for the technology. I'm telling the story of how we got here. I think that the drones raise several issues that we as a society need to figure out how to cope with. One is these drone strikes. You know, we don't the executive branch essentially runs that program more or less without much transparency. Another, you know, drones are coming into the civilian airspace now, and we need to figure out, the FAA is working, the Federal Aviation Administration is working very hard to figure out how to regulate them so that our skies remain safe, and we have to maintain our privacy. The Center for American Progress is a respected think tank in Washington. No one has exact figures on how many civilians have been innocent civilians have been killed in drone strikes, but the Center for American Progress tracks them as best they can from media reports, and they actually find that the number of civilian casualties has declined significantly over the past few years. I think that's true because I think that the people who work on the weaponry try their best not to kill civilians. That's not their aim, and it doesn't do them any good when that happens. But you know, it's not a robotic killer aircraft. You know, it's not an aircraft that's picking its own targets, and the people who are actually flying it with the controls aren't picking the targets exactly. It depends on intelligence from the ground, and if the intelligence is bad, they may in fact fire missiles and kill the wrong people.
Is there concern over blowback from the use of drone strikes around the world in terms of drones as a symbol for American power, for good or ill, and maybe for terrorist recruiters who say, look, Americans are operating drones in our airspace. We need to fight back however we can.
Right. That's absolutely true. And you can imagine how you would feel if you were living, if you thought that some aircraft with no one in it was flying over your neighborhood and might launch a missile into your neighbor's house or into yours. You can understand how fearful that would make you feel. I think that there are even people at the CIA, former senior officials who I was able to interview, worry that the government has become too dependent on using that technology. But, you know, there are two aspects to this, Rob. I mean, one is the drone strikes that have been controlled by the CIA. Another is the use as a military technology, as a weapon to help commanders see the battlefield. And so you have to realize that the drone strikes is actually a relatively small sliver of the uses for this kind of technology.
We'll leave it there for now. Richard, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Richard Whittle. He's a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center. His new book is Predator, The Secret Origins of the Drone Revolution. Lots more news from the courts this week on Wisconsin politics and elections, with yet another court announcement today on voter ID.
Noah Ovshinsky joins us for a look at the big stories in state politics. He's WPR's assistant news director. Noah, welcome back.
It's good to be here. Thank you. And happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Well, we've got an update about the voter ID law from the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. What happened?
Right. So the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals voted not to rehear the voter ID case. As you might recall, a three-judge panel allowed Wisconsin to reinstate voter ID in a ruling 2 weeks ago. The ACLU and others wanted the whole court to hear it in hopes of a different end. And it looks like that won't happen now.
So how did that vote go down? Why was it decided this way?
Well, it was it was not unanimous. It was the vote actually was 5-5, which means 5 wanted to rehear the case and 5 didn't. And in the Court of Appeals, it takes a majority to take up a case again as a full court. So it would have just needed one more vote for the court to take up the case again.
So this answers the question, will the voter ID law be active in time for the midterm elections? It was, and now we've got our answer, it looks like.
I think so, yeah. This means that voter ID will probably be in place, I would say almost certainly be in place, for the election in November. The GAB, Government Accountability Board, and local clerks, you know, assumed that was the case almost as soon as the three-judge panel ruled 2 weeks ago, but now it's, you know, it's even more of a sure thing.
So that's our short-term answer. It's going to be in play for the midterms in November. Long term, could it have some legs beyond that to be finalized in another way?
Well, that depends on the plaintiffs. The ACLU could decide to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. And if they do appeal and if the court takes the case, then this story will, in fact, be far from over. It'll just be the next chapter.
Now, so for voters wondering how this is going to work in the next election, can you run us through it? What do they need?
Right. So, yeah, a lot of this has happened, you know, so fast. First, you know, for those submitting absentee ballots, they'll need to be those absentee ballots will need to be accompanied by a photocopy of your photo ID. Voters who plan on going to the polls need to bring a valid Wisconsin photo ID. That can be a driver's license, a state photo ID, which is free now. You can get that free at the DMV, a military ID or passport.
Okay, so how about university students? That's been a question about, you know, maybe an out-of-state student who's wondering how they can vote.
So, yeah, the UW system is actually issuing new IDs that satisfy the voter ID law. But students will also have to, in addition to bring those new IDs, will have to bring a proof of enrollment to the polls. The system is also making those documents available.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, another Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals bit of news, and I almost feel like we should have a regular segment devoted to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals.
What's happening in Chicago?
Yeah, and in addition to Rob, Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals trading cards that he's proposing. But we've got more news out of there again. This time, Judge Easterbrook just handed down another decision about the ongoing John Doe 2 investigation. What's the news there?
Right. So the Seventh Circuit also made headlines. They ruled that this dispute over the legality of the John Doe 2 investigation should be handled in state court. They basically kicked it down to state court. One of the groups that was being investigated, as you might remember, sued in federal court, saying that the probe violated their free speech rights. The Court of Appeals said the issue really shouldn't even be before them in the first place, and they kicked it back down to the state of Wisconsin.
Okay, now to remind us what the core of this was, what was it about?
Right, so the John Doe 2 investigation was looking into whether there was illegal coordination between outside political groups and the Walker campaign during the recall elections.
And what happens now that we've got this ruling?
Right. So now that the federal court has sort of said we don't want any part of it, it's now up to the Wisconsin Supreme Court now at this point. A few cases related to the John Doe have actually been before them for quite a while, but there really hasn't been any action on them. This new ruling by the federal court puts more pressure on the Wisconsin Supreme Court to do something. They could hear the case or cases. They could decline to hear them. And that would mean in at least one case that it would be sent to the state court of appeals. So down a level in the state of Wisconsin.
So lots of different options there, but it could just languish for a while. It sounds
I mean, it's in limbo, and it's unclear, you know, what part of the investigation these prosecutors would be allowed to continue to do without, you know, a clear ruling from the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals in the state. I mean, that's really unclear at this point. So I would say at best, you know, the investigation is still in something of a limbo.
And from Governor Walker, what has he said about it?
So Governor Walker has said, you know, he really wasn't bothered by the ruling. You know, he notes that, you know, it was a state judge who initially squashed the subpoenas in the investigation that sort of led to the appeals court in Chicago. You know, the judge at the time, the state judge, said there was, you know, no probable cause that a crime or crimes were committed. So again, Governor Walker saying, look, you know, the Court of Appeals has kicked this down to the state level, and the state level, in a way, has already weighed in, and they didn't see evidence of a crime, or at least evidence enough to authorize subpoenas.
And I imagine Mary Burke has a different point of view.
Right. So Mary Burke, you know, probably not surprisingly, says she thinks the investigation should continue.
Okay, so we'll be watching that one. Nothing sounds like real fast is going to happen on it, but it's still out there to watch.
Yeah, I'd say stay tuned.
Okay, in other court news, we've got the latest on the GOP ballot lawsuit that alleged that this year's model ballot wasn't fair. Tell us what's happening there.
Right. So this is in the court system back in Wisconsin. And a Waukesha County judge this week dismissed a lawsuit that was filed by Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald. They sued actually to stop the Government Accountability Board from using a model ballot they felt might confuse voters in November. They argued that there wasn't enough separation between the name of an office and the first candidate. And this year, because Democrats are listed first, they thought voters might think they were the only candidate in certain races.
And what was the judge's reasoning in this one?
The judge tossed it out for a few reasons. First, he said that Voss nor Fitzgerald actually had standing to file this lawsuit because they couldn't prove that they, or rather their campaign committees, would be harmed by the ballots. So they had no standing.
And he also said, I read that this should have been brought by a voter, not by a campaign committee.
Exactly, because in theory it would be the voter affected by these ballots, not the campaign committees. Basically the judge said, if the plaintiffs had problems with the ballots, that it should have been taken up with the GAB first. And of course, the lawyers for the plaintiffs argued that they had already exhausted all of their options, thus the lawsuit.
And in terms of the ballots and how this plays out actually, on the ground on election days, what role do the county clerks play in all this?
They actually play a big role in this because the judge, in fact, in the lawsuit noted that, these were model ballots only that the GAB sends out and that county clerks were free to make whatever changes they wanted to. So if a particular county thought that the ballot was somehow, confusing or unfair, they could change it if they wanted to.
All right. And the GAB, what did they have to say?
Well, they welcomed the ruling. Director Kevin Kennedy told reporters that these ballots were very similar to the ones used in 2010 and 2012 and that they didn't run into problems then. He didn't think they caused confusion in those previous elections. And clearly he didn't think that these new ballots would either.
Okay. And Wisconsin had a distinguished visitor this week. The Secretary of the Department of Transportation, Anthony Fox, was in Wisconsin. What was on his agenda?
Right. So he met with members of the public, elected officials, as well as industry folks, the primary topic being railroad safety. And this meeting comes at a time when the region has seen, as we've talked about on the show before, a huge increase in the amount of rail traffic, in particular trains carrying oil from North Dakota. The energy boom of sorts, has really raised a lot of questions for people in that area, in that region of Wisconsin.
And we had Mike Simonson on the show earlier in the week. He was talking about how Senator Tammy Baldwin and Congressman Ron Kine had written a letter to Anthony Fox saying, especially concerned about the safety of the rail cars. So while he was here, did Fox address that at all?
I mean, he certainly heard about people's concerns about the rail cars. He heard about the potential emergency responses that would be required if there was a spill or accident of some kind. The Department of Transportation is in the middle of crafting new safety rules. And Fox said, he would take the stories that he heard in La Crosse and take them back with him to Washington. He noted that this energy boom that we've talked about is, it's a good news story. But he acknowledges that the country has to, and this is a direct quote, step up our game when it comes to oversight, safety, and all the other things that have popped up since this really boom began. He says his department will put the tools in place to make sure the industry safely grows.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Noah, and have a great weekend.
It was good to be here. Thanks.
We've been talking with Noah Ovshinsky, WPR's assistant news director. He joins us each week at this time for a roundup of the top Wisconsin news stories.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.